Hi, I'm Jonathan Burke, Professor of Finance at the Graduate School of Business at Stanford University.
And I'm Jules van Binsbergen, a finance professor at the Wharton School of the University of Pennsylvania.
And this is the All Else Equal podcast. Welcome back, everybody. Today, we're going to talk about a research paper that Jules and I recently published on occupational licensing.
Yes, that is, we wanted to really understand better how heavily should the government regulate consumer markets for goods and services. And like with many papers, the quest for this paper for us started with a bunch of facts that we saw that we didn't understand very well. To give you a couple of examples, in 1950, only 73 occupations were licensed in one or more states. And only 20 years later, this number had increased to 500. And so we're currently in a world where across all the states, 5,000 different licenses are granted across the country, covering more than, as I said, 500 occupations. So that's almost 100 per state on average.
And what I think is also interesting is the variation across states. Again, Jules, you're more the empiricist, so I know you have the numbers at your fingertips. But if you compare, let's say, California to Wisconsin or Michigan or one of the other states, you get very big variation, right?
Yes. So if we look at California, which perhaps not surprisingly is the leading regulator, it licenses more than 175 job categories. At the very other extreme, or some of the ones you mentioned, but in particular, Missouri and Washington have respectively 41 and 53 job categories licensed. So either, Jonathan, it must be the case that Missouri and Washington don't really care about licensing for consumer purposes, or maybe something else is going on that could help us understand why California licenses 175 job categories and Missouri only licenses 41.
Yes, I think it's unlikely that legislators in Missouri care less about consumers than legislators in California. There's another issue that puzzled us when we looked into this, and that is, if you look at the licensing exam, it is very rare for the exams to actually test the skills that are required. I've only found two cases of a licensing exam that has directly tested the skills. I mean, those two cases are the licensing exam for London taxi cab drivers. Basically, the exam consists of finding streets and pubs and whatever in London. And the other exam, which directly tests the skill, is the mountain guiding exam in Europe. Part of the exam is they take you to a crevasse, they drop you into the crevasse, and they say, get out. And people actually die on this exam. So those are two exams where obviously they could test the skill. And what's interesting about that is a mountain guide can pass the exam without studying. A competent mountain guide knows how to get out on a crevasse. But that's not really the case for most of these exams. If you take the world's best brain surgeon and you ask him to take the brain surgeon's licensing exam, he'll have to study. He won't be able to pass that exam without studying, suggesting to me the exam is not testing the skill that's required. Now, if in fact this was meant to protect consumers, you have to ask the question, then why doesn't the exam test the skill?
To really poke fun about some of these exams even more, Jonathan, what we found was, if you remember, that even psychic readers have these boards where they do exams. And one chief examiner of the National Certifying and Testing Board of the American Federation of Certified Psychics and Mediums was specialized in pet communication. But one thing that we particularly were curious about was, if you're truly psychic, then why is it necessary to really administer an exam to find out whether the candidate is also a psychic? Aren't you already supposed to know this?
I know, Jules, it's really funny. And so at this point, you really have to ask the question, are these licensing requirements really there to protect consumers? And that's basically where we started off. The question we have in our minds is, why is there licensing regulation? And why does the regulation vary so much across different states?
Well, so let's first take a step back, because it seems to me that there is this common perception that governments regulate in the interest of consumers. But of course, there are two parties that are playing here. There are producers and consumers. And it seems to me that most people think that the producers are the ones suffering from the regulation, and the consumers are the ones benefiting from the regulation. The question is, what is that assumption built on?
Yeah, so I think most people would justify that assumption with the following simplistic argument. They would say, look, producers could always choose to restrict themselves. So if the government introduces a restriction, that just reduces their choice set and makes them worse off.
That common perception, I think, is an all else equal mistake. And I think that the reason why it's an all else equal mistake is that this idea that the producers can restrict themselves and that there's no other benefit to them ignores the fact that whenever the government comes in and restricts the supply of producers, things are changing in the market. And particularly, the price for the good is changing.
Yes, Jules. This, I agree with you, is an important or else equal mistake. What we would argue is the people who benefit most from regulation are the producers. In fact, the variation we see in the economy is variation that results because it's actually producers that want the regulation, and the regulation is passed to help producers. So let's understand why.
Well, so let's take a simple example, and it's an example that I think most people can relate to. So let's think about the field of medicine. Let's ask the question, what would happen if medicine wasn't regulated and you didn't need a license to practice as a doctor? And this isn't such a theoretical exercise because even up to 200 years ago, essentially you could practice medicine without being licensed by anybody. And so in that situation, lots of people who have no skill, snake oil sellers, will try to pretend to be doctors and they will try to practice medicine and try to earn the wage of a doctor.
Okay, so let's take this example and let's assume the government introduces regulation and assume the licensing exam works perfectly. So it perfectly separates the good doctors from the charlatans. And now let's think about what effect that has. So imagine that let's start with a world without regulation, and now you want to go see a doctor. Well, obviously, your willingness to pay for the service is not going to be very high because you'll understand that the probability that you'll have a competent doctor isn't that high. There are lots of charlatans, and you may hit a charlatan. And if we compare that to the world where the government regulates and the exam works and we only have competent doctors, well, in that world, you have a much higher willingness to pay because you know for sure you're going to have a competent doctor.
So at this point, we really need to define sharply what does it mean to act in the interest of the consumers? What measure do we use to figure out whether consumers are better off? And I think that the difference that we need to compute is the difference between the benefit that you as a consumer get and the price that you need to pay for the service. And so that difference is what in economics we often call the consumer surplus. And so in the two worlds that you just described, we have to ask the question, what happened to the consumer surplus? Because clearly in the world that was regulated, I had a lower probability of dealing with a charlatan. So my expected benefit is going to be bigger, but I'm also paying a higher price. So now the question is, which way does it go? Does the higher price more than offset the higher benefit or not?
And that, I think, was the biggest surprise in our research. What we found is that under pretty general conditions, and we'll talk about those in a minute, consumers are actually worse off, meaning the price increase is more than the benefit they get. In the world where the consumers know that they're going to a good doctor, they're going to pay a high price, they have a high willingness to pay, and they will see the doctor. So the consumer surplus is the benefit they get minus what they pay. Now imagine we go to the world where they don't know if they're going to see a good doctor, the unregulated. Well, obviously their willingness to pay drops. And so the price of the service drops. And if that was the only effect, consumers would be indifferent. In the one world, they pay a lot and get a lot. In the other world, they pay less and get less. But there's a second effect, and this is pretty important. In the world without regulation, there is much more competition. And because of the added competition, prices are lower. And as a result, consumer surplus is higher.
Yeah, so let's think about that competition effect a little bit. I think we all understand that if producers face more competition from other producers, they have less pricing power. They have less ability to set high prices for the services that they sell. As the competition in the market increases and more producers are present, that puts downward pressure on prices. in fact, more downward pressure than just this probability effect of having to deal with a charlatan wooden plot. And so indeed, that explained why in the end we found that the regulation, while often being presented as being in the interest of consumers, ended up not being in the interest of consumers at all.
And more importantly, who benefits? It's the producers. The skilled producers benefit. In the world where there's no regulation, skilled producers unfortunately have to have low prices because consumers can't tell the difference between a skilled producer and a charlatan, and that hurts the skilled producers, and so they have low prices. Whereas in the world where there are no charlatans, so consumers are certain they are going to get a skilled producer, skilled producers charge more and make more money. So clearly, the regulation helps skilled producers.
This is a pretty general result, but let's think a little bit about a couple of exceptions to when this result could break down. So what if consumers really have absolutely no information and have no idea what's going on? Couldn't it hurt them that they don't know at all who the skilled producers are and don't even know who to go to?
Potentially, Jules. But remember, there's an incentive to collect information. So if nobody has any information about what's going on, then often in that case, the market breaks down because so many charlatans enter. Of course, in that situation, the skilled producers have a great incentive to reveal information. And so what often happens is they form a trade group. The American Medical Association is not a government organization. It's a trade group formed by doctors for the purposes of releasing information, for the purposes of separating skilled producers from unskilled producers. And so there's an incentive from the producers to produce the information that consumers need.
We don't need a government for that.
Yes. So there's no reason in that situation for the government to intervene. I mean, the other issue you could think about is, well, wait a minute. In the example we gave, the government regulates, that removes the charlatans, and therefore competition is less and prices go up and consumers are worse off. Might you not argue that a second effect could occur, which is that when prices go up, that attracts more skilled doctors, increasing the supply and limiting the price increase?
That's a good argument, although there are a couple things to think about when we think about that increased supply. Because yes, in principle, we could say because of the higher prices, more doctors will come and everybody's happy. But first, it takes a very long time for skilled doctors to get into the market because it takes a very long time to be trained as a doctor. So it means that for a very long period of time, consumers are worse off before they become better off. So we have to trade those two things off against each other. But secondly, where exactly is this skilled labor coming from? Because the number of highly skilled people that can do complicated professions isn't limited supply. There are only so many people that can do it. And so we also need skilled engineers, and we also need tons of other skilled professions. So how does it exactly work in the total labor market for skilled labor? That is not so obvious to me.
Yeah, I would say, Jules, I would say there's a very limited supply of high-skilled people. And that making the assumption that we can't generate new high-skilled people is not a bad approximation for high-skill careers. And those often are the most regulated careers. And so if you make that assumption, then the effect on consumer surplus is that consumers are worse off. Now, having said that, a lot of people, when they hear the result, look at us and go, really? You guys really think that we'd be better off without any regulation in medicine? I mean, what if I'm really sick? What if I have cancer and I go to a charlatan doctor? Well, I would say there are two answers to that question. The first is that it's not clear you need to go to a charlatan doctor because there's always some information. And so the question is, if you really are sick, then you need to find a doctor where you think with high probability that they're skilled. And of course, that doctor is going to charge a lot because in a world with lots of charlatans, doctors who are actually skilled are going to say, well, look, I'm skilled. I'm going to charge a lot. And therefore, you're going to have to pay a lot for that service.
I think the assumption that there is quite a bit of information in the market, we see that all the time, right? It's not very hard for a particular profession to look up on, say, Yelp or other places that collected information that consumers and experiences that consumers have had. So there's definitely at least some information out there that you can go by.
And remember, Jules, the most skilled doctors are the ones that pay the most with the existence of charlatans, because they are the ones that get mixed in with the charlatan doctors. So they have the greatest incentive to release the information. I mean, one of the things you could think about is, why would the government be any better at releasing the information than the doctors themselves? You know, the AMA is formed for precisely that reason.
Absolutely.
The key insight, though, is sure, if you have cancer and you really want a good doctor, you're going to have to pay a lot for that doctor. But the key insight is it's still less than you would pay if there were no charlatan doctors. Because if there were no charlatan doctors, everybody knows they're going to a top doctor. But on top of that, there's so little competition, they will raise their wages further. So the insight is you're still better off in the equilibrium without regulation, because you can always go to a really good doctor in that equilibrium, but you won't pay as much.
Absolutely. So let's just sum up and let's be clear about what exactly we're saying. It's not that we're saying that we're not in favor of no regulation. What we're saying is, just assuming that consumers will automatically better off if the government starts intervening and start regulating professions, say through licensing, that is just an assumption you cannot take for granted. And you need to carefully look at the conditions in the market before you can draw such a conclusion. We are very happy to have with us today Maureen Olhausen. Maureen is a former commissioner and acting chairwoman of the Federal Trade Commission. And she's currently a partner at Baker Botts, where she's also the co-chair of the firm's antitrust practice. Maureen, welcome.
Thank you so much. Delighted to be here.
Great. So since the 1950s, we've seen an explosion in the number of professions that need a license. And we were wondering whether you could comment on why you think this happened. What explains this phenomenon?
Well, first of all, you're absolutely right. So in the 1950s, less than 5% of U.S. jobs needed a license. And today, that number is approaching 30%. I think one of the things that really explains is public choice theory, which is the idea that when you have a restriction that has a benefit that is concentrated, but it has a cost that is diffuse among a very broad set of people who have to pay for it, it creates this incentive for public action for somebody to essentially go and lobby the legislature to put in some kind of restriction. Or the other hand, what we've seen, and the FTC's paid a lot of attention to, is private entities. So you've got boards of licensure who are made up of practitioners in the field who then go out and expand and expand and expand the restrictions, and they raise barriers for entry that helps keep their ability to charge more money, but it's at the expense of new entrants and also the public who might appreciate having lower cost options available to them.
So Maureen, based on your answer to the previous question, it seems clear that you don't think licensing is purely for the interests of consumers. So can you comment on that?
Yeah, so for some occupations, licensure is definitely an appropriate policy. So for example, if you have a market failure where there's persistent information asymmetries between the providers and the consumers, so you think about very highly technical fields, or when consumers can't easily observe service quality. And I think that's why you often see it in a lot of healthcare occupations where consumers could face serious risks if they were treated by unqualified individuals, but it's difficult for a consumer to assess the quality of care at the time of delivery. So in those cases, a license requirement might help improve public health and safety and be a very good choice. But where we've seen so much growth in licensing has occurred in occupations where the consumer risks are low or really speculative. So for example, cosmetology, hair braiding, things like tree trimming, where you know a bad haircut or bad makeup is pretty obvious to the consumer and have very short-lived consequences.
So Maureen, if you look across states, you'll see that some states have an enormous amount of licensing and other states have very little licensing. So the question is, what do you think explains that variation?
I think it's really political forces that explain that variation. So in some states, you have the profession or the occupation getting together and going to the legislature and asking for these restrictions to be put in place so that they can keep out entry and protect their higher cost services. In some other states, the way the regulations are set up, you have boards of self-interested members of the occupation. So, for example, there was a case the FTC brought in South Carolina where the state legislature had actually reduced the licensing requirements for going into schools and providing dental cleanings and screenings for low-income students. And they did it on purpose to expand care for low-income students. And then we saw the dental board go in and implement its own emergency regulation to say, no, you know, that has to be a dentist doing that. So we saw this direct conflict with what the legislature had decided. The self-interested members of the profession tried to impose this restriction. Now, the FTC challenged it, and eventually we settled the case, and the hygienists were allowed to go back into the schools. One of the things that we're seeing, which I think is rather encouraging, is a number of states now are starting to actively take a hard look at this kind of occupational licensing, because not only does it restrict the ability of new entrants and the ability to often cross state lines for people to come into the state and practice and start businesses, it also has implications on consumers in the state who can't choose a lower cost service if they want to.
So generally, it seems to us that there is an asymmetry in it's much easier to get a license in than to remove one. Or at least what we're seeing is that the rate at which new ones are introduced is a much faster rate than getting rid of them. But you're saying there are some ways in getting some of these licenses removed. So what do you think are the key ingredients to get something like that done?
I think often it's public exposure, right? So the press starts to pay attention to it, and then consumers start to say, hey, that doesn't make sense to us. And we understand that it's costing us money and it's not really giving us the choices that we want. And sometimes it's antitrust enforcement. The FTC has brought several cases, one of which went all the way to the Supreme Court, having to do with a North Carolina regulation that said that tooth whitening was the unauthorized practice of dentistry. And the FTC brought a challenge there. So there can be a mix of things. And then sometimes, as I mentioned, it can be kind of enlightened leadership at the head of the state saying, what's a way that we can encourage new business growth in our state, encourage skilled workers to come to our state?
So, Maureen, let me ask you a philosophical question. Jules and I have done a previous episode on something we refer to as agreeing to disagree. And one of the insights of Nobel Prize winning research is that generally it's very difficult in a business decision to agree to disagree. If there's disagreement, somebody's making a mistake. So think about licensing. Why would one part of the country, we would need a particular license, and yet in another part of the country, we wouldn't? I mean, it's just hard to imagine that where you live could really influence whether or not there should be a license. Isn't it to some extent the fact that there is cross-sectional variation across states means that some state is making a mistake?
Well, I mean, it does create a wonderful natural experiment. If there is a genuine health or safety justification for the license, you should see worse outcomes in the states that don't have the license compared to states that do. In some areas, for example, to do a real estate closing, you have to be an attorney. But in most states, you don't. And there was a study done showing, were there more problems in real estate closings in non-attorney closing states versus attorney closing states? And the study showed that there weren't, that actually the quality was the same. So I do think that you can test is, you know, for certain occupations, does this really make sense? And I do think some states are just more regulatory than others. And you certainly see variations in different parts of the country, the amount of regulation that they have overall, whether it's occupational or otherwise.
So do you think it would be the preference for regulation, or would it just be the fact that they're more subject to lobbying efforts by the producers who like to have these licenses in place and restrict entry?
I think that's the case for some of the restrictions. And again, you know, it's funny when you talk about this, people often, you're saying there shouldn't be licenses for brain surgeons. Like, absolutely not. That's not what we're saying. It makes a lot of sense to have licenses for brain surgeons. Does it really make much sense to have elaborate cosmetology licenses for hair braiders, where they don't even do the other cosmetology services. So I don't think it's a binary choice, you know, no licensing ever in any profession versus, you know, elaborate licensing in every every conceivable job that you could think of.
I mean, clearly a lot of services that are being provided these days are now provided through the web. For example, telemedicine or other ways in which it's absolutely trivial to get a provider from a different state to offer you the service. Do you think that this technological progress is going to break these barriers in cross-state licensing differences? Because it seems even very difficult to even enforce that you cannot provide the service if it's so easy just to do it over the web.
I do think things like telemedicine, particularly during the pandemic, has really increased the pressure to open up these fields. So for telemedicine, for federal providers, right? So in federal facilities, there has been, you know, changes to allow doctors to operate across state lines. But then there are always countervailing forces too. So for example, in Texas, they implemented a rule that prohibited telemedicine even within Texas. And it was a big outcry, and the FTC looked into it, and then Texas pulled back on that. So you can see that while there's often technological reasons to start to push to allow, you know, opening up of these kinds of things, that sometimes it engenders a response from the entrenched providers.
Well, Maureen, this has been great. Thank you so much for doing this. It's really been very interesting.
It's been wonderful.
Oh, thank you. It's been my pleasure.
Well, thank you, everybody, for listening.
Thanks, everybody. We look forward to seeing you next time.
Thanks for listening to the All Else Equal podcast. Please leave us a review at Apple Podcasts. We love to hear from our listeners. And be sure to catch our next episode by subscribing or following our show wherever you listen to your podcasts. For more information and episodes, visit allelseequalpodcast.com or follow us on LinkedIn. The All Else Equal podcast is a production of Stanford University's Graduate School of Business and is produced by Alumni FM.